Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, June 25th, 2003. Today's session is Baghdad, Jonah, Nineveh, and Us. Session 3 of Every Church, a Peace Church. Presented by John K. Stoner. The number is STJ2003-02. Let's listen in.
Welcome, friends. This is another session on Every Church, a Peace Church. And I'm John Stoner from Akron, Pennsylvania. I spend my time now as the full-time coordinator of this people's movement for change in the church toward commitment to nonviolent struggle for peace. Yesterday, we looked at that fateful moment in history, 313 AD, when Constantine made Christianity the legitimate religion of the Roman Empire. And this evening, we're looking at Baghdad, Jonah, Nineveh, and us. This evening, we're looking at what to do about enemies. The sense in which the whole project is about how to respond to enemies. But Baghdad and us has some parallelism, I believe, to Nineveh and Jonah. And the story of Jonah, I believe, is a story of a remarkably different kind of response to enemies to which God was calling Jonah. Now, back to a few more words about our problem in the church that we face, largely flowing out of Constantine's enterprise to make Christianity legitimate. Not long after that happened, the Christian church began to justify coercive force rather than Jesus' way of nonviolent struggle. And soon came the justification of war itself, along with the justification of slavery and of patriarchy and of hierarchy. And today, I believe we face a monumental struggle between these ideologies of coercive force, the way of empires, and the way of cooperative power, which is a way of describing Jesus' response to enemies. Coercive power uses terrorist weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, chemical, biological, and weapons of mass distribution, cluster bombs, assault rifles, mercenaries, covert operations. All of that is coercive power. That is one worldview, one view of how the forces of evil in the world might be held at bay. That is Virgil's Aeneid, with which Jonathan Schell begins his book, which I mentioned the other day. He begins with this sentence, Virgil says, "Of arms and the man I speak or I sing." That's a vision of power by coercion. The other ideology vying for support today is that of Jesus, a way of cooperative power, which deals with enemies by going to them with an offer of reconciliation and of grace. In the words of Jesus, "You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you." Let me pause there to ask, do any of you know where it is written, "You shall hate your enemies"? Or do you have a comment on that? This is not a trick question.
It just say, "You shall love your neighbor," and he didn't go any further than that. And the next comment in the New Testament was that you shall not only love your neighbor, but love your enemies. Wasn't that by implication?
Well, it may be. You know, Jesus' words are, at least in the way he's quoted, he says, it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. That's all a quote on the lips of Jesus. Now, Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, and I'm sure there are other scholars now who are saying this, who are seeing this, that in the Essene community, the Qumran documents, if I'm putting that together right, this was a radical community at the time of Jesus, and in their writings you can find those exact words: you love your neighbor and hate your enemies. There are specific instructions to hate your enemies. This then would have been a contemporary community at the time of Jesus. That was a view that was vying for public support. Love your neighbor and hate your enemies. So for us today, the question becomes, how do we as Christians respond to those who believe in the use of and who possess weapons of mass destruction? Since that's big in the language of today, weapons of mass destruction, I pause here to ask you to reflect and then to speak. Let's name some names. Who in our world believes in and possesses weapons of mass destruction?
George W. Bush.
Yes. Is that tongue in cheek?
No, it wasn't.
Okay.
However, it's we the people who elected him.
That's debatable.
Well, yeah, that's true. But there's a huge majority, I think, that follows suit with that.
Other nations.
North Korea.
Yeah.
North Korea.
Libya.
India.
Libya,
Pakistan,
Israel,
Soviet Union,
Russia,
yeah,
no, Russia,
India, Pakistan,
China,
Germany,
yeah, and then we may even have little subgroups that are not even nations,
right?
That are just about.
And who knows?
No.
Saddam Hussein, Iraq might have weapons.
Actually, any nation that would commit genocide against its people as weapons of mass destruction.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, given this range of nations you've named as possessing weapons of mass destruction, that's their way of dealing with the threats of opponents, enemies in the world. Given the range of these nations, then as we as a church, as Christian people, try to fashion a response to this phenomenon, what characteristics will a non-hypocritical response to this have to have? That is to say, we will have to start, won't we, where you started, naming our weapons of mass destruction, to address that problem. And it won't be good enough to act as if terroristic behavior or weapons of mass destruction is a problem out there and not a problem in here. I would say that a nation which has terrorized the world with its threat of nuclear destruction for half a century and claims that someone else invented terrorism is a nation out of touch with reality. So our children, if nobody else, are looking at us and asking us, when you begin to address the use of homicidal violence in vast and overwhelming proportions, weapons of mass destruction, when you begin to address that, who are you going to address on that point? And for 50 years, it's been illegal in this country to seriously resist nuclear stockpiles and weapons of mass destruction. Just ask the Berrigan brothers, Phil and Dan, and a lot of other people who have done jail time for saying no to our weapons of mass destruction. So in as we begin to think about then an alternative, that is, we need to begin to think of an alternative to weapons of mass destruction. We need to begin to think about the use of nonviolent power to restrain evil in the world. And I would have to say that in the use of nonviolent power, as others have said, that the world today is about where Thomas Edison was on the use of electricity in his time. We're not very far along in exploring the use of nonviolent power. Now, just to revisit Jonah a moment before stepping into another stage of our look at this, God called Jonah to go to Nineveh. Who or what was Nineveh to Jonah and Israel?
It was the empire of the day.
It was the enemy empire. And so why was Jonah reluctant to go?
He hated them.
What?
He hated them.
He hated them.
And gets feared them in some way, too.
And feared them in some way. Well, couldn't he have just gone and told them he hated them?
God didn't tell him that. God told him to repent.
Yeah. What was the message he was to take?
To repent. To change.
Okay. And, well, so what was Jonah's problem with that? Why not do it?
He didn't want them to be spared. He wanted them killed.
Yeah.
Now, by all appearances, he was afraid God would forgive
would
them.
Save them.
Pardon?
He was afraid God would save them. Lord have mercy.
He didn't want that to happen. And just to take a further moment, you know, in the question in the New Testament comes up a couple of times, and people came to Jesus asking for a sign. And at least in one of the Gospels, I think it's Matthew, this is in the context of Jesus' increasing struggle with the Pharisees and their complaints about Jesus having an embracing approach and eating with publicans and sinners and widening the circle of salvation. Pharisees are unhappy about that. Scribes and Pharisees coming asking Jesus for a sign, and he says to them, there'll be no sign given to you but the sign of Jonah. What do you think the sign of Jonah meant or means?
Forgiveness?
Forgiveness?
Yeah.
What did we just say was the basic problem that Jonah had in the message of the story?
Fear.
Fear of enemies and reluctance to go to the enemy with the message to reach beyond the boundaries is precisely the problem the Pharisees were having. And Jesus said, you'll get no sign except the sign of Jonah. We're going to have to widen the circle of salvation. And but how does that happen? And at this point, for just some more content, I want to read from Vincent Harding, an African-American scholar and civil rights activist. How many of you know Vincent Harding's name? Steve Clements. Well, good for you, Steve. Glad you know something
about Mennonite heroes.
The brother. Yeah, sometime Mennonite, somewhat. The Mennonites were not good to him. And because he was too good. This was published about 20 years ago.
Post 2001 cover on it.
No, it's not post 2001.
Post 9/11.
No, it's about 20 years old. It's a very prophetic book. It lasts very well for 20 years and more. And I'm going to read a little bit at length from this. I don't apologize. I explain why I'm really glad to read sometimes a couple pages from other writers. Because by that, for one thing, I want to say that about everything I know, I'll learn from somebody else. And you are about the same too, I would bet. And I'm glad to give credit to others who have helped me along the way. Another reason I want to read from Vincent Harding is that he is African-American. And I think that if there is going to be a nonviolence movement in the church, it will have to be done with the serious identification with and even leadership of people who have some experience in it, and that is African-Americans and the black freedom struggle in this country. And I think that the white church has truly failed to appropriate that wisdom that learning. And another reason I want to read this is we're looking here now, we're moving in the evening's discussion, how to deal with enemies. We're looking for an alternative to this coercive and homicidal and empire kind of power. We're looking for an alternative. And what I read from Vincent Harding is Vincent in front of a group of, or with a group of U.S. military personnel talking about alternatives to military power. In other words, let's go for a hard case. You know, you say, well, it's hard for me to go back to my church and talk about this nonviolent stuff. Let's listen to Vincent Harding talking to U.S. military personnel in uniform about nonviolence. He opens, the chapter is titled God's Appeal to This Age. And what he says, and I'll just jump ahead, he says that it is possible that the Negro, that this is a great hour, and he uses a term, you know, he was talking 20 years ago, he will use the term Negro, and he says it's possible that the Negro might be bringing God's appeal to this age for nonviolence. He starts a chapter talking about a 5-year-old boy in New York City who had carried a gun, a loaded gun, to school. And he describes how symptomatic that was of the problems of our society. Now that's 20 years ago, I remember, long before Columbine and a lot of other stuff. But then he says this, and I read, everywhere in America there is a deep, often unarticulated fear that the violence of our culture is out of hand and that our children may be among its most vulnerable victims. How do teachers address this great threat to our humanity? And this is a book written to teachers. The title is Hope and History, Why We Must Share the Story of the Movement. So anyone who is a teacher, here is a book written for teachers to help you appropriate and share the story of the movement for racial justice, for democracy, for freedom in this country. Obviously, there are no quick fixes here. The dislocation of our values, the destruction of our play-filled childhood, the acceptance of women and children as punching bags and outlets for male anger, the fixation on lethal weapons as standard equipment for the American family, all these run deep. But the resources that lead us out to an alternative, healing paths, are perhaps deeper. At least that option must not be closed down. So we search, inviting our students on the pilgrimage. Again, it may be that one of the major resources in the struggle for the humanity of our children and ourselves can be found in a careful exploration of the still unappreciated experiments with nonviolent social action that were developed in the course of the post-World War II African-American freedom movement. Indeed, even more important than the specific experiments with nonviolent responses to injustice were the larger human questions the movement was raising about the spirit of violence within us, about the violence of the powers that be, about the creativity and courage that are necessary if we are to develop alternative ways of challenging a destructive status quo. Any just comments on that paragraph where he says, the resources for nonviolent alternatives may be very much in that American freedom movement, the African American struggle. Thoughts, experiences out of that that you would comment on?
One thing the black church and community had, they were in dire straits. They had energy, they were in trouble, and they had a lot of energy to stick with it. We in the white community are kind of floating along. I think we're pretty good still, and we don't feel the urgency.
Okay. Are we in trouble? What do you think, Paul?
But I also think the black community today is not as strong as it was 20 years ago.
There's truth in that. But we in every church, Peace Church, are really working hard to develop links in Washington, D.C. and other places, Atlanta, with black leaders. C.T. Vivian, any of you know him? Steve will know his name. Some of you know his name. He's very supportive, very engaged with every church, Peace Church. He's in his 70s now. Totally dynamic, yet an amazing guy. And he's spoken at several of our events. And Ruby Sales, an African-American woman who went through very deep waters in the civil rights movement, has consented out of her own vision too. She is co-chairing or co-moderating this Every Church of Peace Church movement with me. And I just feel that's terribly important. Now, so he says we combine some learnings for nonviolent struggle out of the African-American freedom movement. As a matter of fact, it was not long after I had heard the news of my five-year-old brother, son from the Bronx, this is a kid who carried the gun to school, loaded a gun, that my wife and I were given new reasons to suspect that embedded in the story of the freedom movement, there might be unexpected hope and help for the child and the rest of us. We had been invited to West Germany by a group of American peace workers to meet with some of the thousands of U.S. military personnel. And it happens that my son-in-law, Andre Gingrich Stoner, was in Germany as one of those American peace workers who invited Vincent Harding over there. So we had been invited to meet with some of the U.S. military personnel stationed there, especially Army and Air Force people. In classrooms, chapels, and living rooms, our March 1989 meetings focused on the meanings that King and the nonviolent freedom movement might possibly have for people who were involved in an institution that legitimized and justified the uses of massive violence. At every point of the encounter, it was clear that many of the men and women we met had not made the choice to enter the service because they were militarists, but because civilian life offered them so little in the way of remuneration, remunerative employment, a sense of dignity and security, or a relatively desegregated opportunity for advancements in non-professional work, to say nothing of safety. Indeed, more than one black male reflected on the dangerous community from which he had come and said, "I came to the military to save my life." Our visit occurred, it was 1989 is when he went to Germany, he and his wife Rosemary. Our visit occurred shortly before the magnificent upheavals in Eastern Europe. But even then, without exception, the conversations we had were candid, stimulating, and often moving. Most important for our Bronx child, though, was the openness of the men and women we met, their willingness to explore, raise questions, examine beliefs, and especially to recollect old truths and powerful hopes that had sometimes been long repressed beneath the camouflage of their uniforms and their lives. Perhaps the most vivid example of these encounters took place in a company chapel one afternoon, where more than 100 enlisted persons and officers gathered for a presentation I was making on Dr. King. As I faced the group in the chapel, it was obvious that the power of the freedom movement had already begun to work, had already been at work, for that earlier struggle in the United States had made it possible for us to have a meeting in Germany in which so many of the military participants were people of color, were women, and were in positions of responsibility. Considering such fascinating paradoxes, I raised with them one of King's central concerns through the use of a story and a set of questions. We were talking about the Birmingham, Alabama campaign in 1963, where the attention of the world had been drawn to the cannonades of water smashing against determined young bodies and police dogs snapping at the limbs of courageous, nonviolent demonstrators. Two of the black young women in the chapel had grown up in Birmingham during those years, and they helped recreate the feeling of the situation, reminding us of the city's well-earned nickname, Bombingham, because of its record of violent attempts at intimidation, especially against any black initiatives for justice. Recollecting that danger, I asked, when King and SCLC were a student on SCLC's Southern Christian Leadership Council, yeah, were invited by Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth to come to this violently segregated city to challenge its unjust ways. How many guns did they take with them? I could feel a sudden pause in the movement of the conversation. I watched the questioning eyes, almost heard them saying within, "What are you talking about? Are you crazy, mister?" Aloud, several persons declared at once, "No guns. They didn't carry any guns." It was an exciting moment for a teacher whose students and fellow seekers were all wearing U.S. Army uniforms. Pressing them into the logic of their own announcement, I said, "But what do you mean they had no guns? How could they go into that violent city without guns? Aren't we taught that you meet violence with violence, that you have to talk the language that people understand?" I continued the questions. "Aren't we taught that you have to fight fire with fire?" For a moment, no one spoke. Then one of the, out of the eloquent silence, a young black enlisted woman sitting up front spoke slowly, thoughtfully, emphatically. "You don't fight fire with fire," she said. "You fight fire with water." As I had seen in so many other classrooms, when the essential wisdom came not from the teacher standing up front, but from one of the fellow seekers in the group, her profoundly simple statement released remarkable energies. Other significant comments came forth, exploring, probing not only the meaning of water in Birmingham and across the American South of the 1960s, but what the water might now mean in their lives, in their works, as the keepers of the great consuming fires hidden in the forests of Germany. Somehow I felt that the black, white, and Hispanic soldiers who were searching there with Rosemary and me had been given permission by the Birmingham story and others like it, had felt free at least to make some tender, tentative moves into the crevices of their own cells, touching places that they had not often entered, just as I had to explore those parts of my own being where I held captive the knowledge of my tax-paying participation in the purchasing of their and our weapons of destruction. Reflecting on the experience later on, remembering the leading role in the discussion that some of the black soldiers, male and female, had taken, recalling the seriousness of their very personal probing for water as they stood around for nearly an hour after the meeting, it seemed exactly what King and his fellow nonviolent warriors would have hoped for. Well, let's talk about that a little. What thoughts, what reflections, does that bring to you in the search for nonviolent alternatives to coercive, homicidal force? Yeah.
Well, one of the things I think that might happen in the church is that someone has to become knowledgeable about conscientious objection and how to help kids who might be interested as they grow older document the things that need to be documented in order for that claim to be taken seriously when the time comes. Because
okay.
You can't just show up and say, "Oh, I'm a conscientious objector," and
right.
Expect to be deferred.
Right. That's tremendously important. And it's such a big task. You know, you can't just drop the idea of saying no to war on a young person and expect it to make any sense to them in the culture in which we live, in a culture in which we are told, "Be all you can be, join the army." Other reflections, thoughts?
Well, we always do this. As a teacher, I get very angry at every suggestion from social reformers, as well as schools ought to. And always somebody else ought to. And we say we should teach the kids to do this. And maybe so, but what are we doing? Have we, for example, as you pointed out in your example, that we're the ones who paid for those weapons of mass destruction. How many of you would withhold paying your taxes? so that you could not support such a government. Not a one, in fact, because you end up in a clink.
Well, you don't. I haven't ended up in the clink for not paying. But I have not paid. Sometimes a full military amount, typical for the military, sometimes, more recently, a symbolic amount. My wife and I put ourselves in disobedience to a law which we feel is immoral, that this forcible conscription of our money for homicidal weapons of mass destruction, that it's important to say no to that. But if you do it in a symbolic way, you hold it with a symbolic amount, the government doesn't throw you into jail as their first move. You have to really insist on it. So we haven't insisted enough yet.
Or they charge the interest on the money.
Well, exactly, and that's that.
You're paying on the interest. So.
That's why we moved to symbolic rather than withholding 50% of the income tax, which would be at least that amount is attributable to military expenditures. Right, they let the interest and the penalty build up and in the end extract more from you than in the first place. But I contend that a movement of symbolic tax resistance, tens of thousands of all the Christians, not just saying, I hate to pay taxes, but saying, I'm refusing to pay a portion of it. Just, it's a stronger political statement, I think. And it is civil disobedience, which is a beautiful thing in its own right.
And how many of us own stock companies that are in some way involved in maybe pharmaceutical, maybe chemical, maybe weapons, maybe whatever.
Sure.
And I mean, you can own stock in, and I'm just making an example in Kellogg, and somehow they own something somewhere else that's making chemicals.
Well, sure, and that needs to be addressed. And I thank you for naming that. And I remind you of apartheid in South Africa
right. And
economic boycotts. Mm-hmm. When you really think something's a great evil, you let your money speak about that evil.
Right.
I think that in the Martin Luther King time, the peaceful demonstration that it succeeded so well, it succeeded because of the type of government, the type of regime, the type of controls that this country has, where, for instance, it would not succeed in a country like Iraq used to be.
Well, we all think about that.
They were able to peacefully demonstrate without being gassed and machine gunned down.
Yeah, that's a familiar interpretation, argument about nonviolent action. But does that explain what happened in East Germany? And a lot of regime changes in Eastern Europe, and let's speak of the Soviet Union itself, where nonviolent resistance was a very major factor in change that regime. South Africa,
South Korea, and Philippines,
Czech Republic, the Velvet Revolution.
Yeah, so I will not agree that nonviolent resistance worked in this country for the civil rights or the freedom movement just because we're nice people and we have a nice government and we do nice things to make democracy work. That doesn't cover all the ground, and there are too many cases where nonviolent power has stood up to the most heinous kinds of regimes and forced change. And if you're serious about that kind of question, again, I recommend Jonathan Schell's book, just published this year, The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People. And in that, he says, he documents through history how the will of the people has prevailed against horrendous homicidal regimes, and that if we're going to have a future, it's got to be by giving a voice to the will of the people, coming closer to the conscience of people.
Arthur Schopenhauer, a famous German philosophers said, all great truth, and I hear it applied to all great justice movements. He said, all great truth is met with in three ways. First, it's ignored. Then it's violently opposed. And then it's accepted as self-evident. And I think the violent opposition to the civil rights movement was interpreted by the government. That didn't work. So let's just ignore them. Let's just, the media, let's not pay attention to the peace efforts. Civil disobedience doesn't make the news. And so they're just kind of ignoring the School of the Americas demonstration. Just ignore it and keep on doing what we're doing. And that's been extremely effective. The government that we're, the violence that we're opposing, is just being ignored. They just go on and do, they don't care what anybody thinks. That's how they're reacting. They're not, they could use machine gun, but they would know that that would result in more emphatic resistance, perhaps.
Okay. And then you said that the third stage is it's the truth of it is accepted as self-evident. Mm-hmm. I'd just like to pick up on the self-evidence of truths. I think the world has not unlimited time to discover that one of the great self-evident truths is that nonviolence is a greater power than violence, that love truly is stronger than hate, and that good overcomes evil. And I want to speak of that as a self-evident truth and speak of it as self-evident in the sense that it resonates with the human heart and spirit. Now, we're indoctrinated, very heavily indoctrinated as Americans, I think as Westerners in the great war cultures we're part of. Our theological traditions indoctrinate us to think that the human spirit is innately very violent and totally depraved and on and on. That's kind of view of humanity is out of control in our culture and in our theology. I take you back to Jesus in Mark 3, where there was a man there with a withered hand back in the room, needed to be healed. And the Pharisees had their law, and it was against the law to heal this man on the Sabbath. And Jesus called the man up front, and he asked a question. He said, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill? And I invite you to live with that question for a moment. Is it lawful to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill? The Pharisees did not respond to Jesus. They were silent, it says. But everybody in that room was answering that question in their own heart. How do you think most of them were answering it? Is it lawful to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill? How do you think they were answering that question in their own hearts?
Anyway. To do good.
Good.
To save lives.
Pharisees ignored it.
Pardon?
The Pharisees ignored it.
Self-evident truth. Where did people have to go to find an answer to Jesus' question? Is it lawful to do good or harm? To save life or to kill? How many books did they have to go and open and read? How many authorities did they have to consult to answer that question? We're talking about self-evident truths. Jeremiah talked about that. He said, the time is coming when I will write my law in their hearts and they will know me, God says. Well, I don't think that talks about a change in human nature or anything, but I think it probably does talk about a cultural and evolution of cultural awareness and of religious awareness, where, as Jesus did, helped us, was doing with that question, we come to a place in our human development where we again get in touch with that which is most basic in our being, and those things which are most self-evident. It's lawful to do good rather than to do harm. It's lawful to save life rather than to kill. So we're talking about how to move toward experiments in nonviolence, Martin Luther, or Vincent Harding's conversation with the military people there, and them thinking about how you fight fire with water. What other thoughts are going through your mind? What's the water? How do we describe this water we use to fight fire and violence?
I think one of them is telling the truth. Telling the truth about your own faith. Like you say, so much of theology and what you might hear in the churches is afraid to really talk about what Jesus' life meant and what his teachings were. Mm-hmm. And it's quite frightening out down the lake to tell the truth about, you know, what just happened over the last few months, all of the presentations that were made to us and all the cover-ups and all those sort of things. And to take a risk in telling the truth, whether you're a teacher or a pastor or just a garden variety citizen.
Telling the truth. Any affirmations of that? Any experiences with it?
Well, in our little church, we're having a hard time with deciding what, you know, pre-war here, what to do, but we have a hard time with the truth now because we have to be sure that we kind of remain status quo to keep the plate the same, because we got a debt, $1.5 million debt. Yeah. So we really can't rock the boat now. It'll come to us in a few years.
Yeah, well, you know, there are a lot of people in the world so poor they don't have anything but money.
Yeah, so you're telling me something about our congregation.
What?
You're telling me something about our congregation that I probably know, but it's a plain reality here. Yeah. We have to get so much money a week. Yeah. So I noticed that the church was very kind of ambivalent on where should we come down on this war issue. We almost kind of let it kind of slide through. And in fact, the plates pretty much staying the same.
This goes back maybe to what we talked about, I think, on Monday or Tuesday, of, you know, the separation of church and state and the fear of maybe bringing politics into our congregations and discussing the fear of the separating the congregation and dividing walls there. I have a question, though. Whose truth? I mean, what is the truth, even? Everybody has their own perception of what truth is for them. And so I have a hard time with that comment.
Well, we can ask the questions like Jesus did. Is it lawful to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill? And with that, you try to help people get in touch with the truth that they know, that they already know. The self-evident truths. I think in the end, probably all truth is axiomatic. That is, you can't prove it, in a sense. You can't prove the sun comes up in the east. You just look and you see, and the circles around you, you see.
That's interesting when you say, though, how it becomes divisive within the congregation. Mm-hmm. And there we have then, almost, we have enemies.
Well, Jesus said that he didn't come to bring peace, but a sword.
Right.
And that was not about nuclear weapons. That was about the fact that there will be some divisions of opinion. And a mother will be set against her daughter, and a father against her son.
We have this sort of common saying, we Lutherans aren't exclusive to this, but we quote Luther as saying that the theologian of the cross calls a thing what it is. It's kind of a reality theology. It's not a theoretical theology. And I think the churches in general have gotten to a point in this country where we sort of live from theoretical or historical theology rather than reality and contemporary theology that speaks to life as it is. And you have to look at life as it is, and you have to speak to it. And if we avoid that, then we have to ask, really, why are we there in the first place? We had a series on peace during Lent this year, and our finances haven't been good, and we're trying to promote a new building project, but we did it anyway. And things are going fine. I think we lost one person who's come back and forth three or four times anyway in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
And he went away to that, and he'll be back in a few years.
Yeah, well, but you'll find other people.
The last sermon was on the evil of preemptive war.
Okay. And you will attract other people. And, you know, you can go for the money, and in the end, all you'll have a building. All you'll have is a building, but not a church.
You don't do it for that reason. You don't do it to attract or chase people away. You do it to be faithful. That's why you're there. And if you're not there to be faithful, then close your doors. Go home and do something else.
Do something
else. The question, I know it's naive maybe, but I always come back to that question, and I don't see anything ambiguous at all about it. Or how you can equivocate, thou shalt not kill. That's a truth. You know, I don't know how you can misperceive that in any way. That says, thou shalt not kill. Now, how do you make a confusing statement, huh?
Sort of, what part of that?
What part of you don't you understand? Thou?
Well, we know that the people to whom God said that did plenty of killing. Did plenty of killing, and they had their death penalty, and they had a whole string of legitimate reasons.
That's what
reasons.
Jesus had to do?
No, I'm saying that's all in the piece of writing we're dealing with here, the collected Holy Scriptures.
It actually says, the Lord said.
Right.
No.
So we...
No, but the Lord said, go in and...
Go in and kill
destroy
them all with a vengeance.
Right.
Yeah. Don't spare any. It also says that. So this has to be dealt with, not just pussyfooted around.
Yeah. I remember reading about an 11-year-old girl who was debating about the violence of the Old Testament versus the non-violence of the New Testament. She came up with the idea, God wasn't a Christian yet.
That's right. Well, you want, yeah, I know what, I think I understand what she's saying. I think, I'm not sure I have the book along, the Jewish scholar Klausner, how many of you heard of Klausner? Wrote on Jesus, did a major book on Jesus of Nazareth. And you ought to read his couple pages on he speaks admiringly of Jesus in almost every way. But when it comes to the question of power and violence and nonviolence, he says, of course, we can't go along with Jesus here. We would lose our peoplehood. We would lose everything. And so that's Klausner's conclusion on Jesus. And I read that and I say, wait, that's a Jewish writer. That sounds like mostly Christian writers. I read these days, you know. So there, yeah, was God a Christian yet in the Old Testament times? Yeah.
Well, this is not where I'm at, but some Christians, like the ones running our country now, who say they're Christian, would say that we have to kill some people in order to liberate or save other people. So that this,
and that's what
I
was,
so this means justifies the end. You know, I mean, but that's, and maybe they're really convicted of that.
Well, they probably are. there was a point in history where
I think that was my point. What you just said is because that is their truth for them. They are truly convicted of that. But to somehow, instead of build further walls and make more enemies, somehow to embrace these people and to, I don't know what the answer is, but I'm really confused right now because what I'm hearing is we are the militant right now because we are for peace and we are the militant right. And that's just what everybody else is saying that we're here discussing we don't want. And so I'm feeling a little bit anxious about that because we're here to reconcile. That's what we want to do, is to reconcile and to bring these people that we think their truth is wrong, but to reconcile that. I'm confused right now.
There's a really important point here, and that is, just as easy to become sort of a peaceful movement that has the truth. But I think in the Christian tradition, it's more than that. And Jesus confronted that. He said, I'm the truth.
Yes.
You know, there's a big difference there. So then it's understanding who is Jesus. And asking ourselves, because that's in fact how we understand who we are as a people. I mean, we are the body of Christ as a church. And therefore, we should be a reflection of who we understand the crucified and resurrected Jesus being in our midst. And that's how, that's the truth is personal. The truth is
okay.
Jesus.
And I don't think it'll help, I'll be right with you, it doesn't help to relativize truth and say, that's your truth and this is my truth. There was a time when everybody's truth was that the earth is flat. And then there was a time when some people's truth was, oh, the earth is round, and other people's truth was, oh, the earth is flat. So the truth is, I think, something else bigger than any of us. We can talk about this as my perception of the truth. That is your perception of the truth. But let's keep believing that there is a truth that is bigger than my perception, than your perception. We can move toward it.
Yeah, I think I was going to say almost what you're saying. I think the truth is not something you can go around it. No matter how intelligent or how much logic you can use to try to justify your truth, there is a truth that is there and nobody can go around that. And if a congregation is dividing, if a country is dividing, a community is dividing because everybody thinks this is their truth, there's a truth that all of them will come to follow, no matter the conditions. And what happens is, what divides actually our congregations, our communities is our own systems. We build systems on laws. And what I ask often is, whose law is actually the law that we're supposed to follow? And our law is based on our truth. Mm-hmm. And so this is telling us that there's still that truth on which we have to base the law. And that truth is the law. So if we cannot accept that fact or we cannot face it, then we become afraid of it. Then we are empowered by the fear. Mm. And we'll never get to that truth.
Okay.
So I think that is something that we need to think about inside the church. I mean, when we fear the truth, it becomes a question of survival. You know, and then I have to pay my tax in order to survive. Or I have to.
All right, thank you, friend.
You know, that's a big salary and things like that. So, and then we build a law that will make me pay a tax so that I can survive. Mm. You know, even if I am surviving at the expense of my child or my family or something inhuman in that in that way. So I think that the truth is just something we have to live by.
Live by. Continue to search for it. Thank you for being here. At 8:45 tonight, we're having another conversation here that continues some of these themes, a panel on how to help your church become a peace church, a peacemaking church, and so we invite you to that. And tomorrow, as it happens, Gary and I are running simultaneously. We're both on the same hour. We're not. We wish it wasn't that way, but that's the way it is. But you can get the tapes, and so you just have to kind of take your pick and hopefully listen to the other tape later.
I could also mention that tomorrow at 1 o'clock we're going to be running a video here on the history of Christian nonviolence. A really powerful education of what the truths are about the early Christian church.